Welcome to another That's a Dive, back from UK. European adventures, European vacation, yank abroad, all that jazz. I'm a little bit jet lagged, but I'm back. I've got my coffee here. PJ's with me. And we're going to kind of split from the format a little bit and just do a storytelling session. Just a little recap, some reflections on the European adventures. Our three trips, one in London to White Hart Lane, Old Trafford for Manchester United, Chelsea, and then finishing it off at Robbie Musto's old stomping ground, the Riverside, up when we watched Middlesbrough Arsenal. But before we get into all of that, there are other amazing podcasts here under the NBC roof, and one you got to check out, NASCAR and NBC. Nate Ryan does an amazing job, and there's actually a pod recently, you got to check this one out, where they look into fighting in NASCAR. I mean, you wouldn't think that would be a major NASCAR topic, but it is, and you got to hear what Nate's take is on that one. So check out NASCAR on NBC. And we've talked about the reviews. One of the things I asked you Tad Potters to do last week was to throw out a review of the pod and also sneak in a movie reference, a quote, a reference, anything. And I picked out some of my favorites. Before I get to the movie references and the reviews, there was one review that I really loved where Matt Dogg said Wilmer Valderrama drives an Aston Villa. So I guess I was so thrilled about my Clint Mathis story where I talked about one night in U.S. camp when we went to Wilder Valderrama's house to pick up his car, and I called it an Aston Villa instead of an Aston Martin. And the review goes, great pod. I never would have known that Wilder Valderrama drove an Aston Villa. Must be a pretty nice ride before it drives off a cliff. That's too good, Matt. Okay, so my two favorite reviews with movie quotes. And remember, guys, if you like the pod, and even if you hate it, give it a good review and come on and write a little something and sneak in your favorite movie quote or movie reference, and I'll read my favorites on the pod before we get started. So Return of the Kyle from Grandpa Flakes. He said, back from an extensive training with a little old green guy, Kyle is here to slice through topics and pick them apart with his suave hair and well-articulated thoughts on football with as much skill as someone would slice through a villain with some sort of green laser weapon at his disposal. Let's not forget Jorge always rocking the sleeves rolled up, button up, and vest look, and keeping Kyle from the harms of the dark side and kissing his sister. Well, this got weird. Great pod, though. That's excellent, Grandpa Flakes. And then Jake 1580, would you like to kiss my lucky egg? It took me a moment for that one.
Yep. It's not the most memorable line from that movie, but it's still,
I got it.
It's still a good one.
I got it. Yeah. Cool Runnings.
Yep.
Feel the rhythm. Feel the rhyme. So you said you asked for a movie quote, and there you go. Favorite sports movie? Question mark. Great pod. By the way, any celebrity appearances in the future? No offense to PJ, because PJ is a celebrity in this building.
I think we will work on that, though, in the future. So, real quick, though, that question, though. Do you have a favorite sports movie you'd want to
favorite
right
sports
now?
Movie? I mean, it's Jerry Maguire.
Okay.
It's got to be. One. I mean, that's up there. For Love of the Games, a weird favorite sports movie as well. So love those. Keep them coming. And, on this pod, we've been messing with the format a little bit. We still want to stick with the three topics. We love that, and we try to keep it in a half an hour because we know I can just go on and on. We used the whistle last week. We're not going to use the whistle this week.
It may return, though.
It may return, though. There may be a return of the whistle. But keep hitting them in the reviews. Keep telling us what you like, what you don't like, what we should be doing. So I'm back. And PJ stuck behind. We had a huge group of people that were still doing the show here from Stanford. But the Robbies, Rebecca, myself, went over to see Graham Lee and Stevie Bauer. And unfortunately, Arla White couldn't join us this time. His wife was in the hospital, but she's making a recovery. We're all thinking about Arlo and his family. But what a trip. It was so much fun. It was special for me because I've been over there as a player, as a fan, and professionally, and seen some of these stadiums. But I've never seen White Hart Lane, and I got to see it this time, and the perfect time, because it's not going to be there next
yep.
year. And
it's basically the last chance.
It was my last chance, so we got over there. And, one of the things you notice when you go to these old stadiums, and it's not specific to Europe, although they have a lot more history than we do, but you go to Wrigley, you go to some of these, Fenway, remarkable old places, and there's just a I don't want to say haunted, but there is a spirit, a history about the place that permeates, that you feel right when you walk in. And when you get to White Hart Lane, you know, the facade on the outside, it already has that sort of old character. And you notice it immediately when you get to these turnstiles that I don't even know how they get fans through. I mean, they are these little slices in the side of the building that you have to move through sideways that are just incredible. I mean, right when you step up to the stadium as a fan, before you even get through the turnstiles, you already sense the history. You immediately go through the Rolodex of all the memories, all the big games that have been played there. And then what I love every time I get to a stadium is when you make your way up the steps and you get your first glance at the field. And one of the great parts about Anfield, about Goodison, about White Hart Lane is how the stands are encroaching on the field. I mean, it just is the most intimate of environments where you take one step off of the last seat and you can step onto the field. And it was so cool to get to do sideline from White Hart Lane. I mean, we had three different positions, three different jobs to do on the weekend. There was the studio job with Rebecca. There was the gantry job calling the game with Steve. And then there was sideline, also with Steve. He was working double duty. And so I did sideline the first day at White Hart Lane with Lee Dixon and Phil Neville. And before the game, we're just, you know, just talking about old games in the stadium and anticipating what we were going to see from Spurs. And it was one cool moment where Thierry Henry, who I know from covering Major League Soccer, got a chance to meet him several times and get to know him, walked over and first criticized Lee on his jacket, on his suit choice. But then, you know, he and Lee sat there and commiserated for a moment about being at White Hart Lane. Obviously, North London Derby, mm-hmm. Arsenal fans don't feel very welcome at White Hart Lane. And there was some friendly heckling going on from the fans that showed up early enough to be able to hear, because when the game starts, you can't hear one voice. It's just a mob. So they were talking about, through clenched teeth, how good this Spurs team is, how remarkable a team Pochettino has built, Daniel Levy has built. And what was so unique was, we're talking about the team, but if you glance to your left, the new stadium's being built. So not only built this young, spectacular team that's battling for top four, but also based on what happened to Chelsea this weekend, now probably battling for a title as well, as it looks like the title race is back on. And the new stadium is being built. And Robbie Musto and I got an opportunity after the game to walk over there and get a hard hat tour of what's going on. And that place is going to be spectacular. And one little design aspect that I love, there's all these cool, you know, modern things about the field being rolled out of there so that they can help grow it and protect it because they're going to share it with NFL. But one aspect that's sort of a throw to the old times that you're worried you're going to lose when you build a new stadium is one of the sides behind the goal is going to be one big, huge, long stand a la, you know, the Yellow Wall or the Kop.
Okay.
You know, one of these that just seems to go on forever and is very steep and intimidating behind, you know, the goal that you're attacking or the goal you're defending.
You maintain that fan presence that you want to have as a home advantage when you're, you know, when you're playing, especially if they're a big rival like North, you know, Arsenal or something.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah. So I love that, you know, there's some, you lose a little bit of being able to fit seats in there, because obviously when you tier it and you put one stand over the other, you can fill in more seats. And they just said, not important. We need one part of this stadium to be intimidating. You don't want to lose that sort of, you know, home field advantage, but Lee and Thierry were talking about how, you know, the Emirates, as beautiful as it is, and it's a remarkable stadium, they lost a little bit leaving Highbury. You know, you lose a little bit of that history and of the memories of how difficult it was to go play there. So it'll be interesting to see what Spurs are like in their new stadium and what the atmosphere is going to be like.
I was just going to say, off of that point real quickly, they had to play their Champions League games at Wembley.
At Wembley, yeah.
They struggled. When they've looked the worst. And a lot of people put sort of the part of the blame because they were playing at Wembley and it wasn't this familiar ground where the fans could interact as much. So I guess we'll see next season when they have.
And they thought about that in the planning. I mean, that kind of goes back to that one stand idea. And, you know, we'll see what that place is looking like. And if Pochettino stays and Harry Kane and Dele Alli and some of these guys stay, they could turn that place into an intimidating ground, because they could be winning trophies there, which is one of the, I think, the first things that turns a ground into a place to fear. But the pitch side desk is special. I mean, that's one of the main reasons we go over there, because we have a presence on the gantry every weekend. The studio, as cool as it is still detached a little bit from the environment. And Robbie Musto was talking about at Old Trafford, the glass is so thick, it's almost soundproof. You can't really feel the atmosphere. But from the sideline, watching the guys warm up feet away from you, Bournemouth was right behind us. But you know, right 50, 60 yards away was Harry Kane and Dele Alli. And, you know, seeing them go through their emotions when you're standing there right on the sideline of that historic ground was pretty special. And you also pick up things you can't pick up when you're not there. The little nuances of whether it be communication between players, facial expressions, or to fast forward to Old Trafford, you know, Marco Alonso, he came off injured mm-hmm. and walked right by Robbie Earl, and they could kind of see on his face that he was uncomfortable and obviously couldn't continue. And then for the game, we got to see, we got to watch behind the Spurs bench. We were three seats behind Pochettino, and you know, to be able to pick up little things from the bench. I mean, one of the things that we picked up that you don't really see when we're in the studio is Pochettino, as well as they played, and they were probably as irresistible as they've been all season long, was not satisfied. He turned around to his bench several times and he was furious, and he had this growl. You know, he would pace back and forth in the technical area, but every now and then he would scream at a player and say their name in this deep sort of primal scream that got their attention every single time. And we just, I was sitting next to Lee, we would look at each other and kind of just laugh at the fact that, you know, when you play in games like that, you try to pretend that you can't hear your coach. There's a lot of times where you just like, you know, I just act like he doesn't hear me. No. Every player, when Pochettino got up and screamed at them, turned, looked over, and immediately tried to make the adjustment that he was screaming about. So White Hart Lane was incredible. We saw Spurs just put on a clinic, absolutely dismantle Bournemouth. And then that night after the game, we had a great little dinner out in London. And actually, the table next to us, I don't know if the soccer community is a small world or if we just picked the right restaurants, but Frank Lampard just coincidentally was at the table next to us. He came over, told us his take on Spurs and also kind of what he's up to now. He's moved into a coaching area and, you know, he's getting involved with Chelsea and obviously doing television work. So it was fun to kind of you know, catch up with him, hear his take on things, and also hear him reluctantly praise Spurs, as Lee had to do all day long.
There's a lot of that going around London right now.
Yeah, there's a lot. Yeah, there's so many teams in London, which means there's a lot of fans and a lot of ex-players that are forced to be complimentary of Spurs when it doesn't come naturally to them.
Real quickly, before we move to the second day of your trip, you one of the, I think, the huge advantages of having that pitch side desk, as you guys get to interview, you got to interview a couple of the mm-hmm. players and managers after the match, and in particular, you just brought up Pochettino. I think this goes with your point about him yelling at the players and getting their attention and them listening. You asked him a very good question about when Vincent Janssen came as the sub, mm-hmm. and they were already winning 3-0. The game's over. They're going to win. He scores the fourth goal, and that was the most excited that Pochettino was the whole match. It's probably the best celebration from that game. And not only that, but the players, too, ran over and were just, it's, you know, just a pile on, a hug of Janssen. And to me, it just showed this unity, I guess, that this team has, that's pretty clear just by watching them. And the fact that when you ask him that question, too, he seemed the most excited.
Proud.
About that moment of the game. Because he knows Janssen's been struggling. He's been mm-hmm. criticized a lot. But he finally got that goal, and now it sort of just relieves his pressure off of Janssen, and you could just, I don't know, just it just showed that out of all the moments in that game, that was the one he enjoyed the most.
You know what he seemed like to me? He seemed fatherly. You know, there was a, I just said it, he was proud. He wasn't happy that they got the fourth and now the game was won. The game was won in the first probably 10 minutes. I mean, they were all over Bournemouth, and everyone's been speculating about Janssen all season long because he's not as prolific as he was in the Eredivisie. And it's not the first time a striker has come to Spurs or the Premier League for that matter and struggled. We just saw it with Soldado recently, who was scoring boatloads of goals before he came. And there was just, you have to ask yourself, when a guy keeps getting opportunities who's a striker and not scoring, there's something else about him, right? And there has to be, especially when Pochettino isn't someone that suffers fools lightly. I mean, look at all the players he shipped out of there because their attitudes weren't right or they weren't right for the squad. He's been giving them opportunities because he believes in them. And you saw that, and the way he celebrated was obviously more for Vincent Janssen, but it was also, I think, a little bit for him to say, you know, I'm believing in him for a reason. So that was a cool moment. Then we also got to talk to Harry Kane, who came over, and I asked him a tough question about keeping this team together. You know, himself being linked with other clubs, but less about him because of his affinity for Spurs probably keeps him around more than it does other players. But guys like Dele Alli, I mean, he's going to have Real Madrid and Bayern Munich and all those teams coming after him if he keeps playing the way he's playing. So I asked him about keeping this team together, and he said to me, There aren't very many teams better than us right now. And I thought, you know, he's right. We actually talked about that at dinner. You know, all the guys got together and we basically just it was a Spurs love session about how good they are and how they're not letting up, and we don't anticipate them collapsing like they did last season. So White Hart Lane was special. We had a great dinner afterwards. The feeling was just that we just experienced something special, even for the guys that have played there and seen games there many times. But that was it, the curtain call for Spurs. And then the next day we moved on to a very special place in Old Trafford. And I'm fortunate enough to have seen a few games there before. I remember coming over and watching my buddy DeMarcus Beasley play there. You know, I've covered games from the studio there, but got to, for the first time, do commentary. Do the co-coms from the gantry there. And, you know, before I get to that, Old Trafford, if you haven't been, is, I mean, there are a few things like it. Obviously, the success that they've had there, but the Busby Babes statue outside, and George Best was one of my heroes growing up. I mean, even before you get to the turnstiles this time, you know, the history and the success and the lineage is on display right as you get to the outskirts of the stadium. And then you walk up to the Theater Dreams, and I this time went through, typically I'd go through the sort of press area and up the elevator to the studio. This time I went through the tunnel where you see guys doing their interviews afterwards, and when you're watching our broadcast, you see us showing everyone lined up on that little ramp headed down to the corner of the stadium. And what's cool about that sort of nickname, the Theater of Dreams, I don't think this is the reason it's nicknamed that, but it does feel like you're going to see theater in the terms of, I don't know if you notice this when you watch games, when you get down the tunnel, the field is up. You know, there's this sort of 4-foot hill you got to walk up to get up to the field. So like when you go to you know, Radio City or you know, you go to Carnegie Hall or something, you're at these old seats that you can tell are old. You feel the history. You feel the brilliance that has been in that building in the past. And you feel that when you walk in Old Trafford. And then you have to walk up, and you have to be careful too. In dress shoes, you might slip and make a fool of yourself. You have to walk up this little hill to get to this stage, this big, beautiful, plush, perfectly manicured grass on this stage where, surrounded by the Sir Alex Ferguson stand and the Bobby Charlton stand, there are these massive, stands that go as far as the eye can see. It's just a remarkable, huge stadium that like any time you walk into a stadium live, just is more remarkable than you ever thought it could be when you see it on television. So before the game, you walk the field a little bit, and then I got to make my way up to the gantry and call a game with Stevie Bauer this time for the first time, which was so much fun. And when you get up into the gantry, there's so many different broadcast positions for all the different, you know, countries and even within England that are sitting there getting ready to do the commentary. So what's so amazing is you're sitting there, there's a buzz before the game. Peter Drury was right next to me. I know he and Jim Beglin from obviously NBC SN coverage. But you're just talking, and there's a buzz about the game. You're waiting for the lineups to come out. And so then finally the lineups come out, and immediately there was this chatter going on. And I hadn't taken a look at mine. I was doing some rehearsals yet, and I hadn't seen the lineup. And you know how you just sense something's up. And I got that feeling as I saw everyone sort of furiously scribbling and sifting through programs and chatting away. Something was going on, and that something that was going on was the fact that Zlatan Ibrahimovic, in one of the biggest games of the season, was on the bench. So immediately everyone's sitting there racking their brains thinking about, what is Jose Mourinho doing? You know, the Chelsea team was as expected. You know, Courtois was back in Courtois was out after his ankle injury from, I guess, filming a basketball advertisement, which yeah. I'm sure Antonio Conte is not too thrilled about. So Chelsea is as we expected, except for the Marcos Alonso.
Which was late. That came later.
Yeah,
but yes.
Yeah, injury. And then we're sitting there just trying to figure out what Jose Mourinho was thinking. He played the two young kids, Lingard and Rashford, up top. And so we all go through our question marks and what we think, and then the game starts. And that wasn't the most spectacular and just sort of brave and irreverent decision that Jose Mourinho made. The braver and more spectacular was, as the game was going on, he had picked Ander Herrera to man mark Eden Hazard out of the game. So in the first 10 minutes of the game, I'm sitting there and I notice it, and I'm thinking to myself, is this really happening? Because honestly, in my entire professional career, I don't remember that ever happening in a game I was playing in. I mean, that was sort of youth soccer. I mean, you couldn't really get away with that at the international level and at the professional level, but it was a masterstroke. He took the former PFA Player of the Year, the shortlist of the PFA Player of the Year this year, and turned him into an average player. It was insane.
How much of that do you think is obviously because he coached Hazard for almost three seasons? He got sacked, obviously, so he knows what he's capable of, how smart he is as a player. Do you think he knew? He's like, I know if I man mark this guy, we can take him out of the game.
Well,
you think he knew all that?
Yeah, I mean, well, I remember they tried it in the FA Cup, and it worked for the most part until Ander Herrera got the second yellow. And if you remember before that, it wasn't a real man-marking job. He obviously was cognizant and staying close. But I think Jose Mourinho thought that was it, that worked. And has, whether he wanted to prove something in a big statement about how much everyone's celebrating Antonio Conte and how much everyone's celebrating how good Chelsea are without Jose Mourinho, I think part of it might have been a little bit of an ego move to say, listen, you know, this team is actually revolving around one player. Now, I don't really think that's the case at all, but based on what he did, man marking him and Chelsea having no answer for that, he kind of made a good case for it. So I have a feeling it was sort of all those things. And if you remember, Jose Mourinho had a battle with Eden Hazard when he first got there about turning him into more of a two-way honest player, making him do the defensive side of things. And it was when he won PFA Player of the Year that he was that player. He was honest.
And they won the title.
And then he sort of reverted back to maybe being a bit lazy, I guess you could say, but also I just think not as focused on willing to do the things that Jose Mourinho had worked so hard to get him to do. And now Antonio Conte has given Eden Hazard freedom again. So he's playing in a formation where he doesn't really have to track back. And the irony, and I said it on the broadcast, was if Eden Hazard was playing both ways, if he was you know, playing more honest and withdrawing and defending, it would have made the job so much harder for Ander Herrera, because it would have pulled him out of the middle of the field and positionally made things difficult. And also, in transition, given Herrera so much more ground to have to keep up with Hazard, who has him burned for speed. But Ander Herrera, during the game, when they were in possession, Manchester United, he'd make a 5-yard pass and then turn around, to turn his back to the ball and back to the attack, and sprint back over to Eden Hazard. I couldn't believe it. I kept hitting Stevie Bauer, and I kept going, are you seeing this? I mean, it's absolutely remarkable. I was on the broadcast. I just give Jose Mourinho so much credit for doing something that, if it didn't work, both things, Zlatan Ibrahimovic, omitting him from the lineup, and prioritizing Europa League. And then man marking Ed Nazar. If both those things didn't work, with all the pressure surrounding him, with how bad they've been at Old Trafford, the worst winning percentage in 43 years, he backed himself into a corner and taken so much stick. So I give him a tremendous amount of credit for making those brave, bold moves, and obviously they paid off. So Old Trafford was a special experience again. We saw two seasons ago the Manchester Derby there, and that was Louis van Gaal at that point, and they had a spectacular, successful day. I can't remember. I think it was like 4-1.
Yeah.
So
I
we've
you
seen.
Guys saw him. You may have seen him at dinner later that night.
Oh
too,
yeah, Louis van Gaal.
Yeah.
Yeah. We saw him at Wings. He's like he loves Wings, which is a Japanese restaurant that that isn't actually all that good.
But it's really well known.
But
in
it's
Manchester,
really well
right?
known. Yeah, yeah, it's where all the celebrities go, and Louis van Gaal loves going there. So after speaking of dinner, after the Manchester game, we went out in Manchester for a great dinner. And speaking of you know famous soccer players being there, some of the listeners might not know this guy, but you should go Google him if you don't, and look at the YouTube footage. But most of you will know Brian Robson, who Robbie Musto played with at Middlesbrough, and is a Manchester United legend, and. Soccer nerds like us, when we get to dinner and we have a few drinks, what we do is we do our favorite 11s. You know, your best Premier League 11, you know, best all-time 11, best Chelsea 11, best Manchester United 11. And we did best Manchester United 11 that turned into, because there were so many arguments about positions, just top 10 Manchester United players of all time. And not Sir Brian yet, but he will be, I'm sure, Brian Robson was in the top five. Lee Dixon and Robbie Earle and Graham Lasso, Robbie Musto, putting them in Manchester United's all-time top five. I mean, that's how good that guy was. And he came over to our table, and it was really funny. He gave Musto a little bit of crap and told our bosses who were at the table that they should fire him, which got everyone laughing so hard. It was hilarious. So Manchester was an incredible time. We had a blast there and then hopped in the car, speaking of Robbie Musto, and finished off the trip up at the Riverside, and Robbie Musto spent I think 10 years of his career playing for Middlesbrough up in the Northeast, and I'd never been up there. I hadn't seen a game up there to whether it be Sunderland, Newcastle, anyone, and one of the most intense and celebrated parts of the country in terms of how diehard fan bases are. We went to the Riverside for that Monday game against Arsenal. Obviously, a lot of pressure on Arsene Wenger and Arsenal coming into that game, but also in Middlesbrough to try and stay up. They're in this relegation fight. They're bottom. They're in that drop zone. And you know, it was less about that and more about Robbie Musto showing us his old ground. He was obviously proud. It's just so cool to bring friends to your old home. But to see how much the fans loved him and how much the stewards loved him, everyone in the stadium remembered him, and it had been a decade since he'd been back. It was really cool to see how much it meant to Robbie Musto to be back there, but also to see how much it meant to these fans to have one of their star players back.
I was just going to say, he actually gave a great tour of the stadium that we aired during the show, and it's actually available online too. If you can check it out on NBCSports.com, but. You know, if our bosses take Brian Robson's advice and decide to sack Robbie Musto, I think he's got a future as a tour guide.
He was amazing. There's some really cool. There's some really cool shows that we filmed there. That one where Robbie kind of shows everyone around. We did a sort of pundits in the locker room show at Spurs. That's a lot of fun where we talk about managers. And then there's an I Was There that will kind of wrap up, kind of like what we're doing right now, just wraps up an amazing trip being over there. But this time I was in the studio with Rebecca and Graham Lasso. And before the game, we did a little mini tour. We got to look around. And as the game was gearing up, we just felt a little bit worried for Arsenal, a little bit worried for Arsene Wenger. I mean, on the day, you would say, it was there had to have been more pressure on Middlesbrough. I mean, they have to start winning if they want to stay in the Premier League. But the the anxiety before the match was really just all about Arsenal. And so what we do before the game is we get an opportunity to kind of all trade our thoughts and think about, you know, what are we anticipating? What's going to happen today? How are our teams going to set up? And speaking about, you know, the Manchester United game where there was team news beforehand that got everyone buzzing and everyone scratching their heads trying to figure out what Mourinho was about to do. Well, here we go. We're at the Riverside. The lineups come out, and we're hearing from Lee Dixon and all his connections that Arsenal, for the first time under Arsene Wenger ever, are going to play a back three. Are going to play a back three against the worst attacking team in the Premier League. So for the first time in Arsene Wenger's career, he makes a tactical adjustment to pay attention to defensive stability against a team that together have scored fewer goals than Lukaku has by himself. It was remarkable. Mm-hmm. So we're all sitting there before we go on air, we get this news, and we're just in our mics in a trading kind of theories back and forth, trying to figure out what was going on.
Yeah, I think I remember when Lee first was reading out the lineups to everybody, he actually kind of stopped. He's like, wait a second, is that right? Is that really what he's doing right now? Nobody could believe it.
Well, I had to throw in because I was doing the lineups. I had to say, you know, and they still might be playing the back four because we had to kind of protect ourselves because even though he had said it and Lee had heard it through his connections, we still were skeptical because of what a big development that is. And here's my theory. One part is, and I don't want to be hypocritical. I said this on the commentary because I'm one of the ones, and most of us are in this camp, spending every week criticizing Arsene Wenger for not putting more focus on Arsenal without the ball. Team shape, how they press, you know, how they defend, set pieces, the zonal, marking, all these different areas where I feel like if you look at all the teams above them, every single one of them focuses without the ball. You know, Pep Guardiola would be the only one that maybe you could lump in that category, but he's been criticized highly because of that this season as well. But starting from the top, you know, Chelsea, Antonio Conte that's the first focus. Before they even get to how they play when they get the ball, it's about who they are when they defend. Then Jurgen Klopp and Pochettino, both of those guys spend a lot of time on how, you know, both of them, if you think about their strategy, it's more about how they press rather than you know, making it difficult for other teams to break them down in defensive postures. But it was remarkable to me that Arsene Wenger finally made that decision. So I was hesitant to criticize, but then you start to think to yourself, okay, but now against this team, against Bournemouth, that's out of all the times you could change the back line, you decide to do it now. And here's the thing is that for the first time in his career, in 2 decades, he makes a tactical defensive adjustment, and they still concede to the worst attacking team in the Premier League. So it's not as if it really worked out all that well. So one theory is that it was a suggestion to, and maybe a statement by Arsene Wenger, that he's willing to change. Because behind the scenes, it seems like this discussion, and we had it already on the podcast. I think we did that on our first episode. Maybe our second episode.
Wenger was the first episode.
It was, yeah. Right out of the gates, we had to get to that one. There's a suggestion that the hesitation from the board and from Ivan Gazidis and the owners in giving him a contract extension and locking him up for a few more years is that his obdurance, you know, just so stubborn and won't change his ways, whether it be in the transfer market or whether it be in trying to play the same beautiful way but dying in beauty in terms of the title race every season. Was this a statement from Arsene Wenger to his fans, to the board? I can change. You know, you can teach this old dog new tricks. So if that is the case, I actually kind of like it. I like that he'd do that.
Well, and the other thing you kind of touched on it there is if you're going to experiment with this or debut it, there's probably not a better team
to pull it out on. Yeah,
it's a good team to test it out on. Probably.
Yeah, because if it doesn't work, I mean, I guess that's the other point. That's a really good point. Is that maybe this isn't the team you bring it out on? Because if you bring it out on a Manchester City or a Liverpool, and it's not working too well, which it didn't seem like in a week of preparation they had it down. You could get crushed, and then he takes a lot more criticism. I like that, PJ. See, PJ's here for a reason. That's why everyone wants you on the pod.
I was going to ask you real quick, the one sort of maybe disadvantage you also have in the studio is you're not on the pitch side for the interviews again. Wenger did come and do an interview with our guys, and our guys asked him a lot of questions, and trying to get to the main question that everybody wants to know, but we know he's not going to answer what his future is going to be. But so aside from that question, what would, if you were on the pitch side for that, what would the one question be that you would have wanted to ask him?
What I want to ask him, and the difficulty is he's really good in the press with answering the questions he wants to answer and not getting into things that he thinks are rabbit holes that someone's going to have a good quote or be able to push him to answering something he doesn't want to answer. I would ask him if you could point to one reason why this team keeps failing in title races, what would it be? I mean, that's what I want to know, because they've changed in so many ways. So the spending, right? Recently, they've started to do it again. You know, I obviously fans want more. They want them to break into this, 100, 150 million pound war chest they keep bragging about. But Alexis Sanchez and Mesut Ozil didn't come cheap. By the way, neither did Xhaka and Mustafi. So they started to spend money recently. Sports science in terms of injuries. They brought in Shad Forsyth, who I actually worked with at the LA Galaxy, who, with athlete's performance, he was one of the ones behind Germany's World Cup victory. I mean, he really brought in and installed the fitness routine that helped make that team so successful in a tournament scenario, which is very difficult. So that's another area they focused on. What's the constant? I mean, Arsene Wenger. Arsene Wenger is still there, and I don't think he obviously wouldn't say myself, but he has to know. He has to be able to highlight why that keeps happening. And it can't be that the Premier League's a tough league to win, because why did Leicester win it? Don't tell me that Leicester have a better chance at winning the Premier League than you do. They have fewer resources. They have a less talented team. They had a less experienced manager in terms of Premier League and title races. I mean, Arsene Wenger's at least won the Premier League. Claudio Ranieri's never won a title until he got to Leicester. So that's what I would have asked him, and he wouldn't have answered it. And he probably would have said, don't let that guy ask me questions anymore. But it was an amazing trip. I had a really good time, and got to do three different jobs, which was a lot of fun.
So out of the three, what would you say was your favorite part?
Probably the commentary. Yeah, being able to do co-coms, because I don't do that much anymore, and I love it. And to be able to call the massive game on the weekend, the big Manchester United-Chelsea game, was a special treat, and be able to do it with Steve Bauer, calling the first game with him that I ever have.
I was going to ask
a lot of fun.
Real quickly about that. Like you said, it's the first time you ever called a game with him, but just in general with your play-by-play commentator, how do you establish sort of the flow and the partnership? Is it just kind of happen as the game goes, or do you have to have a talk before? Is there just what's kind of the,
you know, it,
the workflow
it
for
totally
that?
Depends on who you do it with. Some people are prepare more, and there's a little bit of a sort of pre-interview, where you kind of get a sense of what the game style is. I mean, I've listened to Bauer so many times, so I know much more about him than he knew about me. But we honestly didn't have one conversation about the game commentary. We just let it flow. We just let it happen. And Bauer's so good at making it very natural and opening up spaces that are easy to come into. So it was. It also was a great game to do because of how exciting and how interesting tactically it was, but also how great the game was. I mean, you didn't have to really force anything. So it was a lot of fun. It was a special treat, obviously, to do it at Old Trafford, special treat to do it for such a big game, but also just to do something I love to do, which I haven't been able to do a lot lately, which is commentate the game. But there are some people that probably wish I wasn't on the commentary.
There's always some trolls.
Yeah, so what we did, which was a lot of fun, was dipped into the social media rabbit hole, the quagmire, to pull out some of our favorite mean tweets about Martino's commentary. Let's just dive right in, Jorge. This is some of the remarkable reviews that I got, starting with Lion Alexander, who said, about to mute my TV with at Kyle Martino doing commentary on this match. I mean, the good part about that review is he said about to. We don't know if he actually followed through with
he was,
that.
He was thinking about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, he was thinking about it. But maybe I convinced him. And then there's at RonLon8, who said, at Kyle Martino, please stop talking, which is polite. He said, please.
that way.
You know?
It is polite. I was just going to, but that's kind of what you're supposed to do as a commentator, though, is talk. So I don't know.
That was probably his point. That was probably his point. Then there's at that underscore Nels underscore Cray, petition for Kyle Martino to never, in caps, do commentary ever in caps. So there's a petition out there. It's got six signatures. So if you want to join that petition, jump on in, sign your name. At LipMac, forget the score. Kyle Martino commentating makes me want to rip my skin off. I mean, maybe he has poison ivy and he should get that checked out.
Maybe you're helping him out.
Maybe
then.
I'm just trying to get him to go see a doctor finally for whatever's going on with his skin. I want to rip my skin off. Oh my God, that's so good. This one's one of my favorites. At what whale is Kyle Martino drunk? Question mark. I wasn't, but later on that night, I got close. In our amazing dinner where we were talking about our best ever 11s, and Brian Robson came over to say that Robbie Musto should be fired. Here's one. This will be their last one. I mean, I could just go on and on, but here's where we should end this one. At NBC Sports Soccer, you love when they copy your boss. I watch UK football to hear Brits talk about their game. Replace the Yankee doesn't work for me. Which, you know, I mean, that one's funny because it kind of gets to the crux of what was amazing about getting to do the big game of the weekend is there is a group. An ever-shrinking group that some of these wonderful, very complimentary people fall into that just don't want to hear Americans. They just don't want to hear it.
Even if they are American themselves.
Yeah, well, it's funny. There's you know what's actually shrinking is the expat group that has a prejudice against Americans. And what's growing is kind of a soccer hipster group that think it's authentic to not like American voices, kind of like Twitter hooligans. You know, they think like this is right. This is what you're supposed to do when you're a true fan of the game. You know, it's all fun. It's all funny. And the reality is that what I've noticed in doing this game for a long time, especially covering the Premier League. I mean, I was doing it all the way back in my Fox days, is that the predisposition to not like an American has shrunk, which is awesome. I mean, it's so awesome that back in the day, NBCSN throwing me on Manchester United Chelsea for the weekend just would have been met with so much opposition. And what's leading the open-mindedness of the modern fan is actually the expats. You know, it's the guys that are at the bars, at the football factory with the scarves that just love the game and also respect content. Because listen, if it was about your qualifications to talk about the game, then these people would, like when Ruud Gullit and some of these guys get on, They would love them and think they're the best ever. Michael Owen, they would think these guys are the best thing that's ever happened to television. But those guys are brutal and so critical of those guys. So really what it is just there is a group, as I said before, that's shrinking that don't really care what you say. They just don't like how you say it. So they don't like your accent. If you were to put kind of like a Pepsi challenge, you were to either find a way to change accents and make them all the same or put a transcript of the broadcast in front of them, they wouldn't be able to tell the difference most of the time.
Yep.
And I mean, that's what's – I mean, these are so much fun because, you know, you're never going to be loved. And by the way, if you're loved, you're doing it wrong. But what's cool is, you know, back in the day, an American – on an American network, you know, first off, the fact that NBC has every Premier League game broadcast to an American audience is remarkable. I mean, when I was little, I couldn't even find it in English. I mean, I was listening to Serie A in Italian. I was listening to the Bundesliga in German, and I was even sometimes listening to the Premier League in a different language. And the fact that we have this comprehensive wall-to-wall coverage is cool. But then the fact that there's, you know, there's an American sitting in a booth with Steve Bauer at Old Trafford calling Manchester United Chelsea is just a testament to how far we've come, because just rewind, you know, not even 5 years ago, and people were not as willing to accept and invite that. So what a cool weekend. What an amazing experience to once again go abroad and just have a blast and deliver to our amazing fan base the show that they see, and to do it from the stadiums over there is so cool, because we're so lucky to have these jobs. We're so honored to be able to talk about a game we love for a living, and our fan base deserves the sort of dedication that NBCSN puts in to go all the way over there and to put together a weekend that is so difficult, as you know, to pull off. It's just cool, and it's kind of a thank you back to the fans for watching every weekend. But the other side of this thing is we got over there, and to brag about ourselves for a second, which I can do after reading tweets that said people want to rip their skin off when they listen to me. There were so many Brits over there that travel from time to time to the States, and one very high profile Brit in Sir Alex Ferguson who said they love the coverage and can't believe that you know we're doing what we're doing over here. So it's because of you guys that we can do it. It's because of you guys that we have a big enough budget for Jorge and I to sit here and talk to you. I mean, to be able to scrape together $500 to put this podcast together for a season. No, but in all honesty, listening to the pod, the reviews, watching every weekend, we love you guys. We want to keep doing it for a long time. What do we have? Definitely. 5 more years?
Five more years. Contract, yeah.
And then who knows after that?
I just want to throw out there real quickly too. We did put this list together of mean tweets, but we could have put one together because you're not going to say this yourself, but there were a ton of, and this speaks to the growth and acceptance of American commentators. We could have put together a list just as long with complimentary tweets about your commentary as well. So.
And half of them were my family members because I've got a really big family. But no, thanks for saying that. And again, guys, thanks for listening. That's it for the Tad Pod this week. And remember, Tad Podders, stay on your feet.